Welcome to Let's Do It Radio, sponsored and found on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. If this is your first time listening, we want to welcome you and hope that you continue listening to Let's Do It Radio. Today is Tuesday, June 22nd, 2021. This is your hostess, Miss Inez, CEO and fashion designer of Ana Isabel Cool Designs, broadcasting to you worldwide. And our guest speaker this evening is Miss Janet Schwartz out of Indiana on the topic of the artist who changed history. You can visit Ms. Schwartz in the client section on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com while listening to any of our shows where all of our entrepreneurs of Let's Do It Radio can be found. So please join in the conversation or Skype during today's show at our number 845-241-9985. Doitallinthemall.com is owned and operated by Sharon Salisbury Fraser and has been in business for over 13 years and is a secure 24/7 online shopping mall of over 5,000 stores for all of your needs. You can shop while listening to entertainment, all in the comfort of wherever you may be. You can make a difference nationwide and worldwide. So visit, take a tour, and shop. Hey, lights, camera, action. That is the song we are here listening to right now. There we are. The rights.
We do not own the rights to any information or music you hear at Let's Do It Radio.
And then we're going to hear a song by Yuna on Lights and Camera, as today's show is The Artist Who Changed History. Yes, that was Yuna on Lights and Camera. As tonight we speak about the artist who changed history. And as we bring in our teacher, Janet Schwartz, on the topic of the artist who changed history, she's going to take us on a journey of some of the pioneers who made Black lives changed and Black lives matter. So you can chime in on this topic by calling in or Skyping at 845-241-9985. And that means school is in session. As we bring in our teacher today, Miss Janet Schwartz. How are you doing today, Miss Janet?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. Well, nice weather today
good, here in Indiana.
Perfect weather.
Oh, it's good. That's good. We've had, well, I've been traveling all over, so we've had wind, rain, storms, and everything else. I think that's what came out of the hurricane, Claudette, good old Claudette, making history. So, yes. So what are we talking about tonight?
The artists who changed history. We have a lot of good things to talk about. Oscar Michaud, Josephine Baker, we got the Harlem Renaissance, Langston Hughes, Ethel Waters. I mean, these are great people to talk about, and especially the Harlem Renaissance, that a lot of these people were
involved.
That's
always interesting.
Part of the Harlem Renaissance. So that's what we got on tap tonight.
I got on tap. We sounds like we're going to have a sound like we're standing at the bar. What's on tap tonight? Okay, we got that.
Yeah.
The artist who changed history. And those are some pretty big artists as well. So I'm ready to get started if you are.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and who is our first artist of the evening?
We have Oscar Michaud, and these two clips we're going to listen to will show us that he was the first Black independent filmmaker. And you know, in the days before Spike Lee came along and other independent filmmakers, he was the first Black independent filmmaker. So why don't we go ahead and play the two clips?
All right. Our first one is, as she said, the first Black indie filmmaker, and the second one is Frame by Frame.
Long before Spike Lee, John Singleton, and Julie Dash broke barriers for Black cinema, Oscar Michaud became the first major Black filmmaker to produce and direct his own films. Ever the entrepreneur, Oscar Michaud left home at 16, became a train porter, and then a homesteader. Supporting a farm was anything but easy. Michaud turned to writing as a new source of income. And in 1917, Michaud would publish a book that altered his future forever. It was called The Homesteader, and he adapted it into a silent movie, which he produced independently. The Homesteader began Michaud's career as the first major independent producer-director of Black films. His work critiqued the racist stereotypes of Black people, typically depicted in Hollywood films.
You are seeing a whole range of Black characters on the screen, assertive, articulate, often sophisticated, strong characters who are trying to do something for themselves and the community.
His fifth film, Within Our Gates, directly rebutted the blatant racism of D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, a three-hour-long piece of Jim Crow-era propaganda.
Within Our Gates responds directly to Birth of a Nation. The negative, stereotypical portraits of Black people that were shown there were not how Black people really were. And then, showing that white supremacy was really the main problem in the South.
Other films, like The Symbol of the Unconquered and Body and Soul, sought to entertain while also delivering social commentary.
He covered issues that were not being covered in film, generally speaking, lynching, discrimination, struggles around employment, class differences amongst African Americans.
Censor boards often edited Michaud's movies or rejected them outright. He used these attempts to censor his work to his advantage, marketing uncensored versions to curious and daring audiences. Forced to fund his own work, Michaud's success was self-made. Over a career spanning more than three decades, Michaud created more than 35 films and is considered the most influential African-American filmmaker of his time.
And the next one is Frame by Frame.
Hi, I'm Wheeler Winston Dixon, James Ryan Professor of Film Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and this is Frame by Frame. I'd like to speak for a minute or so about Oscar Michaud, a pioneering African-American filmmaker who was born in 1884, began his work as a novelist, and when no one would make his novels into a film, he did it himself. He began with a film called The Homesteader in 1919. He made a response to D.W. Griffith's incredibly racist Birth of a Nation with Within Our Gates, and he continued on to make films in both the silent and the sound era up until 1948 on marginal budgets of $5,000 to $10,000, releasing the films himself, distributing them often out of the back of his car, the trunk of his car. He would travel from state to state and distribute them, along with another filmmaker, Spencer Williams, whose films like Blood of Jesus represent an enormously important part of cinema history that's been overlooked. At that time, the dominant cinema did not represent African Americans in any positive light at all. And so these films of Oscar Michaud and Spencer Williams are extremely important not only as documents of cinema history, but also in giving a voice to those who were being marginalized by the dominant cinema. So Oscar Michaud's films are now available on DVD, and you can easily rent them. Some people criticize them for their lack of production values, but when you're making a feature film for $5,000 to $10,000, I think you certainly have to cut a few breaks to the people who are working under such enormous conditions of adversity. And his films, I think, are absolutely beautiful. So Oscar Michaud, pioneering African-American filmmaker. I'm Wheeler Winston Dixon, and this is Frame by Frame.
That was nice. Oscar Michaud. So... nice French name. Was he French, or was he just born under that?
I have no idea. You know, I didn't look that up. I believe he was born here in America. I couldn't find anything when I went to research him. I couldn't find anything that said that he was born anywhere else.
So,
yeah, Michaud is a French name, and... maybe he, well, he was born in Metropolis, Illinois. So
okay.
Who knows? Maybe somebody migrated from the Louisiana area and one of his ancestors possibly and gave him the name of Michaud. So he was the first black indie filmmaker. What's that? You're going to Google it, aren't you? I'm going to Google the ancestor of Oscar Michaud. But I can tell you, he was born in Metropolis, Illinois. Look up
Metropolis. He was.
Yes, he was.
Okay.
Where is Metropolis? Why don't you Google that?
Well, that, but it's like, let me see. Metropolis is just like Metropolis, so I can't spell. You know how we always
Chicago?
Have a gun.
Yeah.
Well, it's just Metropolis is just like Metropolis, Illinois. Let me see. Hey, Birdie
All
in
right.
the back.
That's right. The birds are chirping.
Metropolis.
We got my birds in the background.
Tourism.
Coconut the parakeet.
Okay.
And MJ the African gray. African gray. Go ahead.
Okay. No, African gray what?
Parrot. African gray parrot.
Oh, okay. It says, welcome to Metropolis, Illinois, where heroes and history meet on the shores of the majestic Ohio River. This all-American town has been a must-visit destination for Superman fans since being authorized by the National Periodicals, DC Comics, to be known as the adopted home of Superman in January of 1972. Metropolis has become more than a comic fan mecca. The world-renowned events that celebrate the history, hunting, and yes, Superman, as well as action-packed casino outdoor wonders that take you through the Shawnee National Forest or even under the water through a Boeing 272 airplane, Metropolis is a town that has been added to many bucket lists. So it's on the southern tip of Illinois, and it borders Illinois and Kentucky. So that's where it is.
Okay.
So Metropolis. So that, because I never thought of it as Superman, but now, but now that I hear that, it's like, okay, I understand that. Metropolis, Illinois. Mm-hmm. Okay. But as far as Mr. Oscar Devereaux Michaud, he was African-American, of course. Although a short-lived Lincoln Motion Picture Company was the first movie company he owned and controlled. It doesn't say anything too much about his ancestry. So he was just born, say, with the name, and that was it. He had a spouse, but other than that, nothing.
Right.
Oh, yes, it does. I lied. He was the fifth child born to Calvin S. and Belle Michaud, who had a total of 13 children. In later years, Michaud added the E to his first name. His father was born a slave in Kentucky. Because of the surname, his father's family appears to have been enslaved by French descendant settlers. French refugees and had settled into Virginia in 1700. Their descendants took slaves west when they migrated into Kentucky after the American Revolutionary War. So voila. Of course, there's more, but we won't read about it. But yeah, so he was taken in by French descendant settlers. So cool.
Right.
You got to know your history, and you know if you don't know it, you know who's going to find out, right?
Yeah, exactly. I love how you Google things on the side to add to all the material that we have to talk about here, and
but
I just appreciate that so much. So anyway, he left home at age 16. Mm-hmm. Can you believe that? To homestead.
Yes.
And he wrote a book called The Homesteader. You know, they always say write what you know. You know, write what you know.
Right,
and that'll get you off the ground. And so that's what he did. He made this book called The Homesteader. And he actually sold it door to door for a while until it got.
Okay. Okay.
So that's how he got sales for this. And then eventually they made it into what they say, a motion picture. He took the material, and when the regular film places wouldn't put it into a film, he went ahead and did it himself. Now, before we get on to that, I do want to say the movie, the book itself, The Homesteader, you can find it on Amazon. It's $7.95 paperback. So you can go to the Amazon section of doitallinthemall.com and order The Homesteader. And there are other books there too, so that were written by Oscar Michaud that you can look up. So I thought that was a decent price, $7.95 for a paperback.
That's not bad at all.
The Homesteader.
That's not at all.
No, it's not. So he made these strong characters.
And
as,
I have to tell you, he did. And I'm looking at it. You know me as I'm the Miss Googler. The Homestead, it involves six principal characters, and the leading one is Jean Baptiste, played by Charles E. Lucas, a homesteader far off in the Dakotas, a lone African American living in the area. To hit this wilderness arrives Jack Stewart, a Scotsman, with his motherless daughter Agnes, who doesn't know that she is biracial. And Agnes, Baptiste meets the girl of his dreams. Peculiar fate threw her into the company of the homesteader. But because Baptiste is black and Agnes is presumably white, their love is forbidden, of course, by law. Baptiste eventually sacrifices the love of his girl of his dreams, goes back to his own peoples, and marries Orlene, the daughter of a black preacher named McCarthy. And one of the characters, her name is Inez Smith. And that is my grandmother's maiden name as well. So, but it's like, okay.
Yeah.
So you people, that doesn't sound right. So The Homesteader is spelled S H-O-M-E-S-T-E-A-D-E-R. So that is The Homesteader. Mm-hmm. And as Janet was saying, it can be found on Amazon. She'll do it all in the mall.com. So it brings a day, you know, where you can't marry who you love, so you have to marry who you're with. And so, you mm-hmm. know the song, Love the One You're With?
Right.
He had to go back home and leave the one he loved and marry someone else. So that mm-hmm. is, you know, part of the history of The Homestead of the book. But Janet always brings these wonderful things, and it gets me Googling and wondering, and it's like, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
there we
people
go.
Think, you know.
The Google mama.
Yes. The Google,
now,
Google
let me
Meister.
Say something here. Yeah, let me say okay. something here. Between 1919 and 1948, he wrote, directed, and
okay.
distributed more than 45 films. And the films,
wow.
the theaters that were showing these films, the theaters that were showing these films
uh-huh.
were on what was called the ghetto circuit. And
okay.
the particular
okay.
circuit, the official name of it was called the Chitlin Circuit. And it
the
was
Chitlin
based
circuit.
Through
exactly.
The Chitlin Circuit. It was based
mm-hmm.
at,
mm-hmm.
through the Eastern, Southern, Eastern, sorry, Eastern,
come on, get your
Southern, and Upper Midwest, not Southern, but Southern and Upper Midwest. So
Southern.
The whole area there, Eastern, Southern, and Upper Midwest was the area that contained the Chitlin Circuit, who would show his more than 45 films. And like I said, these films, he portrayed blacks as strong characters, showing people that
yes,
they were
just like
anybody else,
mm-hmm,
in defiance
mm-hmm.
of D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. And he funded his
mm-hmm.
own work. He funded his own work. And you can still buy his
all of
films.
It.
Mm-hmm. Funded all of his own work.
And
like I said, you can still
mm-hmm.
buy his films. Now, I didn't look up on Amazon
okay.
whether or not the films are sold there, but I'm sure there's somewhere that sells them.
Yeah.
Google Mama.
Yeah. No, I was. Do you know what Chitlin is? Do you know what Chitlin is?
I know what a Chitlin is, yeah.
Okay.
It's
I didn't. Because you know me. Yes, it is. And they are, you know, they are good, depending on who
well,
does them, because they're not everybody can do
okay.
chitlins. Trust me. And they're called chitterlings,
right.
is what they're actually spelled.
Right.
But,
chitterlings
is what they, yeah, chitterlings. Yes, it's like ugh. But
mm-hmm.
we would eat all that stuff. But anyway, I'm going to say the Chitlin Circuit was a collection of performance venues throughout the Eastern, Southern, and Upper Midwest areas of the United States that provided commercial and cultural acceptance for African-American musicians, comedians, and other entertainers during the era of racial segregation in the United States from at least the early 19th century through the 1960s. The Chitlin Circuit was considered to be by, for, and about black people. The topics of the plays were farcical and over dramatic. There's a debate as to when the Chitlin Circuit peaked. Some say it peaked in the 30s, and some say it was after World War II. Another say it was a time of the blues. So regardless, it is still, I think, going on. I think there's always a Chitlin Circuit. So it is
mm-hmm.
what it is. So we have
mm-hmm.
to do what we have to do to get by, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like we said, the normal theaters would not show his films. He would show up wanting
no.
to show them, and they said, no, no. So he had to go somewhere else to get it out there.
Yeah. And sometimes you just have to create your own thing, create your own
uh-huh.
terms and conditions, as I'm going to say. Sometimes that's what you have to do, create your own
yeah.
terms and conditions so that they can be conducive to you and what you do, because otherwise we wouldn't have what we have unless people sacrifice the things that they had done.
Right.
True.
Right.
So,
and if they didn't,
so cool.
you know, these are people that went
mm-hmm.
through a lot of division and segregation and racial oppression. And
correct. To, correct.
You know, I just admire the way that they pushed on to get their work
mm-hmm.
out there regardless of the obstacles
right.
out there. I know that kind of sounds trite, but it's not.
But
when
it's
you
true.
Think about
it is true.
Someone born in 1884, mm-hmm. you know, 1884, leaving home at 16 and striking out on his own, and there's, you know, there's a lot of obstacles for African Americans during that time.
Right, yep. right. That is mm-hmm. so true. And the thing at that age, being so young, I'm surprised you didn't become a slave, but we were emancipated in Juneteenth, 1865.
Right.
And you can always go back and listen to that episode as well mm-hmm. at your leisure. So, oh, yeah, it's just amazing the things that we as Black people have to go through, had to go through, and are still going uh-huh. through. So
right.
That's what that's about. So, yeah, buddy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, buddy.
Oscar
so
Michelle.
Who do we have next on our agenda? Yeah. Who do
we have
next on our agenda? Who's next on tap, I should say, as you said.
On tap at the bar, no? On tap. We have Miss... All right, now. We have Miss Josephine Baker, born in 1906.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a pretty talented individual, and we're going to learn whether or not she was accepted here in America and what she did with her American citizenship based on
yes.
the audience reception of her. We have Josephine Baker.
So.
We have one clip about the life of
mm-hmm.
Josephine Baker.
Mm-hmm.
It says the sad ending,
the life
but it's
sad
it's,
ending. Right.
Well, That's not really true, a sad ending. The sad ending is that she died eventually.
I'm not laughing.
I mean, I don't know why it's called. I mean, we're all going to have an ending, and it's sad when
right.
we all
yes.
die. So the
correct
wording gives you the impression that her life just went downhill, and that's not true.
Like it was a catastrophe. Yes. Right. It was really tragic.
Right.
And it wasn't. I mean, you
right.
know. You know what? Let's just let them listen to the clip and then
right.
decide for themselves. So you can always
right.
call in at 845-241-9985 if you want to join in the conversation about the artist who changed history. And the next person on tap or up in the box is Miss Josephine Baker.
The life and sad ending of Josephine Baker. Josephine Baker was born Frida Josephine McDonald on June 3, 1906, in St. Louis, Missouri. Her mother, Carrie McDonald, was a washerwoman who had given up her dreams of becoming a music hall dancer. Her father, Eddie Carson, was a vaudeville drummer. He abandoned Carrie and Josephine shortly after her birth. Carrie remarried soon thereafter and would have several more children in the coming years. To help support her growing family at age 8, Josephine cleaned houses and babysat for wealthy white families, often being poorly treated. She briefly returned to school 2 years later before running away from home at the age of 13 and finding work as a waitress at a club. While working there, she married a man named Willie Wells, from whom she divorced only weeks later. It was also around this time that Josephine first took up dancing, honing her skills both in clubs and in street performances. And by 1919, she was touring the United States with the Jones Family Band and the Dixie Steppers performing comedic skits. In 1921, Josephine married a man named Willie Baker, whose name she would keep for the rest of her life despite their divorce years later. In 1923, Baker landed a role in the musical Shuffle Along as a member of the chorus, and the comic touch that she brought to the part made her popular with audiences. Looking to parlay these early successes, Baker moved to New York City and was soon performing in Chocolate Dandies and, along with Ethel Waters, in the floor show of the Plantation Club, where she again quickly became a crowd favorite. In 1925, at the peak of France's obsession with American jazz and all things exotic, Baker traveled to Paris to perform in La Revue Niger at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées. She made an immediate impression on French audiences when, with dance partner Joe Alex, she performed the Danse Sauvage, in which she wore only a feather skirt. However, it was the following year at the Folies Bergère Music Hall, one of the most popular of the era, that Baker's career would reach a major turning point. In a performance of La Folie du Jour, Baker danced wearing little more than a skirt made of 16 bananas. The show was wildly popular with Parisian audiences, and Baker was soon among the most popular and highest paid performers in Europe, having the admiration of cultural figures like Pablo Picasso and Ernest Hemingway. She also received more than 1,000 marriage proposals. Capitalizing on this success, Baker sang professionally for the first time in 1930, and several years later landed film roles as a singer in Zuzu and Princess Tam Tam. The money she earned from her performances soon allowed her to purchase an estate in Castelnaudefarec, in the southwest of France. She named the estate Le Milland and soon paid to move her family there from St. Louis. In 1936, riding the wave of popularity she was enjoying in France, Baker returned to the United States to perform in the Ziegfeld Follies, hoping to establish herself as a performer in her home country as well. However, she was met with a generally hostile, racist reaction and quickly returned to France, crestfallen at her mistreatment. Upon her return, Baker married French industrialist Jean Lyon and obtained citizenship from the country that had embraced her as one of its own. When World War II erupted later that year, Baker worked for the Red Cross during the occupation of France. As a member of the Free French Forces, she also entertained troops in both Africa and the Middle East. Perhaps most importantly, however, Baker did work for the French Resistance, at times smuggling messages hidden in her sheet music and even in her underwear. For these efforts at war's end, Baker was awarded both the Croix de Guerre and the Legion of Honor with the Rosette of Resistance, two of France's highest military honors. Following the war, Baker spent most of her time at Le Milland's with her family. In 1947, she married French orchestra leader Joe Boulan and, beginning in 1950, began to adopt babies from around the world. She adopted 12 children in all, creating what she referred to as her rainbow tribe and experiment in brotherhood. She often invited people to the estate to see these children, to demonstrate that people of different races could in fact live together harmoniously. During the 1950s, Baker frequently returned to the United States to lend her support to the civil rights movement, participating in demonstrations and boycotting segregated clubs and concert venues. In 1963, Baker participated alongside Martin Luther King Jr. in the March on Washington and was among the many notable speakers that day. In honor of her efforts, the NAACP eventually named May 20th Josephine Baker Day. After decades of rejection by her countrymen and a lifetime spent dealing with racism, in 1973, Baker performed at Carnegie Hall in New York and was greeted with a standing ovation. She was so moved by her reception that she wept openly before her audience. The show was a huge success and marked Baker's comeback to the stage. In April 1975, Baker performed at the Bambino Theater in Paris in the first of a series of performances celebrating the 50th anniversary of her Paris debut. Numerous celebrities were in attendance, including Sophia Loren and Princess Grace of Monaco, who had been a dear friend to Baker for years. Just days later, on April 12, 1975, Baker died in her sleep of a cerebral hemorrhage. She was 68. On the day of her funeral, more than 20,000 people lined the streets of Paris to witness the procession, and the French government honored her with a 21-gun salute, making Baker the first American woman in history to be buried in France with military honors. Goodbye, Josephine Baker.
Mm-mm-mm. 13 years old, though, really?
Yeah. That, they did say, they, okay, she ran away at age 13. And then they said in 1919 she started dancing. And 1919 she was only 13 years old. The same age as when she ran away.
Right.
So she was already performing when she was 13 years old, or started to.
Right.
So that's amazing. And, you know, she performed in Paris wearing only a feather skirt.
Mm-hmm.
That had to be
bananas
something.
And feathers.
Yeah, 16 bananas.
And that's what she was famous for. Yes, yeah, that's what she was famous for, her bananas and her feathers. And she dressed, we call it, exotically, I guess you could say. So it was interesting, really interesting. I loved her. Mm-hmm. I loved how she just, you know, and the children that she brought up under her quote-unquote feathers, if you want to say. But no, she was amazing. I mean, you know, and then she tragically died from a brain hemorrhage. It's like, so that was
right.
That's why they said it was tragic. So
I love how she worked for the French Resistance, and that they did messages in her sheet music. I always wondered how was that done. You know, did they write certain notes in the music that had a code to it, that you had to break the code by reading the sheet music? I just wonder about that.
I'm thinking,
I mean,
it's
that
just
would
in
make
the
sense.
Song, just like in the right. But I think it's just in the song, like the Negroes would sing, you know, about things, but you didn't know what they were singing about. You know, talking about, you know, the slaves go north, and you know when you see the star, da 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 da, then you go to this house, da 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 da. You know, so that
true.
Is how they got it, and that's how they told the stories, and that's how they sent people, you know, to freedom, because in the story, what was it, Harriet Tubman? You know, that's what they did. They knew she was leaving, and so they sang about her, sang to her, you know, about go on, you know, get your freedom on. So then she came back. But that's how I think how things were what do you call it, sent on as far as coded in my eyes.
Right.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
so,
I would have loved to see and know how she did that. Right. And then she hid it in her underwear also. And it's more like people back then, they would sew those things into their clothing. And just as a side note, during the Second World War, the spies that would go from America over to Europe, they would leave out of Nova Scotia with things sewed into their clothing. And the interesting thing is that was a point in time when you didn't buy your clothes off the rack. You had to go to a tailor or to someone. And so the people who came from America that left Nova Scotia to go spy with these notes sewed into their clothing, they had to get their clothing from the exact tailors that people over there used, because when they'd come into a country, a European country, and get their baggage checked, you had to have your clothing look just like it was made by the tailors in Europe. So, you know, they had those messages sewed into their clothing, and I wonder if that's what she, obviously that's probably what she did. So...
Interesting.
And then she adopted
Very
12 children. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She adopted
called the Rainbow,
12 children.
The Rainbow, not called, yes.
The Rainbow Tribe. And she invited others to see the children to show that you don't need racial barriers. There
there doesn't need to be barriers based on race, that everybody could get along. But 12 children, that's a lot, you know?
Yes, yes.
I can't imagine that taking care of 12 children.
Well, it's no different than in the other one. Marcel was, what, the fifth of 13? I mean, a lot of these people had large families. A lot of them had large families, you know.
Right.
And as they were talking about her, Josephine Baker, she says, allegedly she transported secret messages embedded in her sheet music, and she'd even smuggle secret photos of military installations pinned to her underwear.
Mm.
So that's what they did.
Mm-hmm.
They pinned them to her underwear. So it's like, okay, you're not going to do too much, you know. So
right.
Mm-mm-mm.
Right.
Oh, wow.
And then
wow.
And then she went on to be in the March on Washington and was a speaker that day in 1963 with Martin Luther King. I thought that was interesting. I mean, I didn't know that she took
when she came back to America. Then?
What was it, 1975, I believe?
Okay.
She died of a cerebral hemorrhage. Right. Mm-hmm. I have the date that she went back and they gave her a standing ovation. That was in 1973, and I believe they said she died in 1975 of a cerebral hemorrhage.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-mm-mm.
I had no idea. I mean,
woman.
I know she did work. She did work in with racial. What do I want to say? She worked alongside Martin Luther King, trying to break the racial barriers and working for the causes. And I had no idea she was there in 1963. As one of the speakers that day, that Martin Luther King was. I thought that was pretty cool.
Bad.
And then the NAACP designated May 20th as Josephine Baker Day. So we'll have to celebrate that next year. May 20th, Josephine Baker Day.
May 20th. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. She was asked to fill the role of civil rights leader. In the wake of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, King's wife, Coretta Scott King, asked Baker to inherit her husband's position as the leader of the civil rights movement. Baker ultimately declined due to the fear of endangering her children.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Right.
I mean, that's what they got to do. Sometimes you got to just stay out of the spotlight because, you know, people are, quote-unquote, I'll say crazy. They're just crazy. And they will take anything away from you that they can to the best of their ability. That's just sad. But that's just how they are. It's crazy.
Right. It is crazy. She also was the first black woman to star in a major motion picture. Now, I don't know what motion picture that was, but yeah, she was the first black woman to star in a major motion picture.
Okay.
And
you know what I'm doing.
Another thing, when she performed, she refused to perform in front of segregated audiences. She wouldn't do that. She only performed in front of racially mixed. Yeah. She'd only perform in front of she refused to perform in front of segregated audiences. That was her way of protesting. So,
great woman. She performed
A lot accomplished in this woman's life with the French Resistance and having her Rainbow Tribe and then taking on racial activism with Martin Luther King Jr., having Josephine Baker Day. Right. And the fact that she finally was honored in America in 1973 when they gave her a standing ovation, and she just wept openly when that happened. So that's what
and
we got about Josephine Baker. What's that?
That's a shame that we have to go away to get recognized.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's just,
yeah, it was a
that,
shame.
That's, and even Jesus had to do that. You know, even Jesus did that.
True.
So, you know, you know, people at home don't appreciate you as they do when you go away.
Yeah.
And she considered her nationality France. I'm looking up, of course, you know me, Google, Miss Google Fang.
Right.
But
Miss Google Llama.
She, Google Meister. Yeah, she just was amazing.
Yeah, Google Meister.
She just, you know, she died April 12th, 1975. And was buried with military honors. Yes, she was. Yes, she was. She was born in 1906. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. That's
what
that
a life.
Cool. And it's, you know, even though I won't say it was short lived, she was what, 69 years old, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's I think she was 69 years old when she passed away. Mm-hmm. And she died in France. So, wow.
Uh-huh.
That's just, my hat's off to you, Miss Josephine Baker.
Yep.
That's
still
just
want to
see
amazing. That skirt made of 16 bananas.
Well,
a skirt
it wasn't
made
actually
of 16
a skirt.
Bananas.
That's
what they said.
And I'm looking at it right now. I'm looking at it right now. Is
the picture?
And I don't know if they're real. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She,
okay.
As she was known for her unique costumes, and it's www.crfashionbook.com. Then you know, you can check on celebrities, but yeah, I just clicked on that. But the first picture of her is her with her skirt, but she had like under it was sewed like to the waistband.
Right.
But they were they were jeweled bananas, okay?
Oh, okay.
And it says, Baker garnered attention due to her distinct dancing styles and creative costumes in Dans Sauvage, the show was skyrocketed her to fame. She danced in a skirt made of upturned bananas designed by surrealist Jean Couture. Dolls all around the Europe began wearing these banana skirts. And more recently, Beyonce paid homage to Baker's iconic outfit during her 2006 Fashion Rocks performance. So,
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yes. So, it's, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I'll
like
send
that
to you.
Yeah.
You know me. I'll send that to you. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I will definitely
you
send
will.
That to you.
And
we do have a caller. I'm going to see who the caller is. And welcome them to our show. So caller ending in 6998, welcome to the show. And would you like to tell us who you are and where you're calling from, please?
Wade from Manhattan.
Hello, Wade from Manhattan. How are you doing today?
All right. Just listening.
Well, we appreciate you calling. Yeah. I think you called in last week as well, didn't you?
Yeah, that's correct. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you for calling in. Hey.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. Mirror on the wall. Yes. So he's going to become one of our avid listeners and callers, and so we appreciate you calling in. And tonight we're talking about the artist who changed history, and we just got you talking about Josephine Baker. And he first spoke about Oscar Michaud, who was as the first black indie filmmaker. So, you have anything else on? Yes. You have anything else on Miss Josephine, Miss Janet?
No, that's it. That's it. We pretty much talked about her full life, and which was amazing. And we covered all the bases.
Yes.
What an amazing woman.
All right, I'm going to play a commercial, and then we're going to come back, and Miss Janet is going to introduce our next clips.
Welcome to Do It All in the Mall, an online shopping mall providing over 5,000 stores. We earn a commission when you shop that goes back to your community, making a difference nationwide. Take a tour and shop doitallinthemall.com.
There you go. You want to introduce our next couple of clips that are on tap?
Sure. We're going to talk about the Harlem Renaissance. The first clip is about a brief history of the Harlem Renaissance. And the second one talks about an explosion of art, how the Harlem Renaissance was just an explosion of art where all kinds of artists, singers, writers, painters, all of that came together and made history mm-hmm. in Harlem. That's what the second one will be about. So go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be rude and interrupt you.
No, I was finished. No, you didn't interrupt. I was finished.
And I'm going to put the links also that we're talking about in our chat room. So if anybody out there who wants to chat online with me, please, you're welcome to go to the chat room and chat online with me and comment, talk about, you know, converse with me. But I will, because if you go to these links, there's some beautiful artwork in these links that we speak about this evening. And so the first one is, like, as Ms. Janice says, the history brief. And the next one is an explosion of art and extra history.
Throughout the 1920s, Harlem experienced a cultural and intellectual explosion that became known as the Harlem Renaissance. Who was involved in the Harlem Renaissance? What was the ultimate impact? Harlem is a neighborhood in New York City which has a very large African-American community. Harlem became a destination for African-Americans throughout the early 1900s as part of the Great Migration. As more blacks made Harlem their home, it increasingly became well known as an African-American cultural center. Poets, writers, artists, musicians, and philosophers were all key parts of the movement. One of the key components of the Harlem Renaissance was music. Jazz performers including Jelly Roll Morton, Fats Waller, Duke Ellington, and Louis Armstrong perfected their music, which became very popular amongst white audiences. It was also during this era when the piano was incorporated into the jazz style of music. Traditionally, jazz bands had included primarily brass instruments. Intellectuals such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey argued and debated issues of racism, ethnic pride, and other topics related to African American life. Poets such as Langston Hughes introduced a new form of poetry known as jazz poetry. African-American literature of the era included themes such as how slavery had impacted the African-American culture and how to combat stereotypes of black Americans. African-American clothing also drastically changed during the Harlem Renaissance. Black men started wearing zoot suits. These were suits which featured long coats with padded shoulders and wide lapels. Women wore low-slung dresses, silk stockings, and open-toed slippers. Both genders wore hats with wide brims. Leopard skin items also became popular, as they were seen as a connection to traditional African garb. The Harlem Renaissance had a profound impact on the United States, as well as the world. African-American artists, musicians, and writers began to be respected on an international level. Not only were white audiences listening to and enjoying black music, but white composers and musicians began incorporating African-American rhythms and harmonies into their own pieces. The Harlem Renaissance also helped to change the world's perception of African-Americans. Prior to the 1920s, blacks were thought of as uneducated farmers. However, thanks to the Harlem Renaissance, a new image of sophisticated and intellectual African Americans began to emerge.
Next, the Harlem Renaissance, an explosion of art, an extra on history.
New York, 1918. It was called the Great Migration, the degradation, discrimination, and agricultural servitude of their lives in the American South spurred African Americans to search for better opportunities in the northern states. They went by the thousands. While some of these migrants landed in bustling cities like Chicago and Detroit, a great many of them found a home in Harlem, New York. And while most settled into a slightly improved life, they also brought something that changed the landscape and demographics of the previously white-dominated part of the metropolis. Art. Art that would serve as a catalyst for a cultural explosion. From cool jazz that redefined American music, to provocative sculptures and paintings, to soulful film, literature, and poetry deeper than the Hudson River. And all of it speaking to African-American life and experiences. Originally known as the New Negro Movement, this profound moment in history would not only redefine the perception of American blacks, it would shape their own identity. For there was to be a renaissance in Harlem. As we continue to educate ourselves on black history in America, we urge you to join us in supporting highly important institutions, such as this week's organization, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, which for 95 years has preserved, protected, and fostered a greater understanding of the black experience through its collections, programs, and scholarships. You can learn more and donate via the link in the description below. In order for any renaissance to come about, you need a specific set of ingredients. The first one is pretty self-explanatory. You need artists. And thanks to the aforementioned migration, black artists came to Harlem in droves. Though it should be noted that many from the Afro-Caribbean community also took their chances in making their way to this city, looking for better prospects and patrons. The second ingredient is a guiding force to channel and direct all this creative energy. And that was especially crucial with this particular movement, since it was seen by black intellectuals as a way to smash stereotypes and do away with the image of the African-American as only good for manual labor and menial work. The man who stepped in to fill that role was scholar and civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois, who at that time served as the editor of the NAACP monthly magazine, The Crisis. Du Bois resolved to use the publication as a staging point for the movement, an idea he articulated by publishing a sort of manifesto on black theater. It was expected to be, as he said, about us, by us, for us, and near us. He also founded the organization CRIGWA, a loose acronym for Crisis Guild of Writers and Artists, and sponsored a playwriting contest for scripts about the black experience. The hope was to broaden the types of stories told about African Americans on the stage, since that was one of the few types of mass entertainment where black people could control their own narratives. You do not have to confine your writings to the portrayal of beggars, scoundrels, and prostitutes, the contest rules instructed. You can write about ordinary, decent colored people if you want. As a result of this prodding from civil rights leaders and theater critics, a host of plays produced at this time included a complex reflection of real African-American life. In fact, as time went on, not only did more all-black theater companies form, but they even began overshadowing New York's mainstream white playwrights. Seeing this success, other literary organizations sponsored their own prizes for fiction and poetry. Zora Neale Hurston got her break, winning the Opportunity Literary Journal Contest, and eventually became a staple of the movement. And poet Langston Hughes was first published and promoted in Du Bois' The Crisis. Both breathtakingly prolific writers who produced crucial works, Hurston and Hughes would be included in the New Negro Movement anthology curated by the country's first black Rhodes scholar, Alain Locke. Other influencers in the scene were quite different, such as William Elmer Harmon, a wealthy white real estate developer who created the Harmon Foundation in 1922. Originally, the foundation focused on building playgrounds and creating nursing programs to assist lesser-served neighborhoods across the country. But it would soon be known for providing a platform for black painters and sculptors to showcase their unseen works. While at the time, many whites fraternizing with blacks were suspected of trying to recruit African Americans to the socialist cause, Harmon was clearly a stone-cold capitalist. While not a champion for equality, Harmon knew that helping African Americans make economic gains was better for the country as a whole. So his foundation set up local exhibits and national tours and established the Harmon Award for Distinguished Achievement Among Negroes. Winners in the 8 categories, which included both music and fine arts, received a medal and $400. While the Harmon Foundation threw its support behind raw talent, prominent individuals like Du Bois and Locke believed that black Americans should create African-influenced art as a way to uplift the race. Locke, noting that European superstars like Picasso and Matisse were themselves delving into African-influenced imagery, firmly believed that art from black people should look different than that of whites. It was a concept that met with some controversy in the movement. painters like William Edward Scott beautifully captured African-American and Haitian subjects, but were considered too conservative and traditionally European in form. And while Scott would go on to win a Harmon Award and etch out a career in Paris, his work was often passed over by Locke and other influential thinkers. And this debate over the aesthetic and long-term goals of black artistry would take on different forms within the arenas of cinema and music. Oscar Michaud, regarded as the most successful black director and independent movie producer of the first half of the 20th century, told the exact stories that the black elites of the Renaissance were looking for. With some of his movies set in the black mecca of Harlem, his 44 films met both critical and commercial success. His characters were not the shucksters and mammies found in white-dominated films, and there were no white actors in blackface. They stood tall, spoke clearly, and had poise, dignity, and agency in films like Within Our Gates and Murder in Harlem. Plus, he didn't shy away from social commentary or tackling complex issues like passing for white or lynching, with his work providing a rebuttal to the critically acclaimed yet abhorrently racist film The Birth of a Nation, which glorified the Ku Klux Klan. But while black elites embraced Michaud, there was still some trepidation in regards to jazz and the blues, much of which had been brought up from the South. In the long run, however, the music proved too infectious to fight, and jazz and the big band sound permeated the consciousness of Harlem, then the entire country. And with that came the much-needed third ingredient for the Harlem Renaissance: patrons. As word of Harlem's nightlife spread, it enticed many whites to come out in droves and see a show or two. And not just in the well-heeled spots, like the legendary Cotton Club that catered to white clientele. The smaller nightclubs and cabarets also found themselves packed. Excited whites would socialize, dance, and drink in the same establishments as black patrons and performers till all hours of the night, which at this time was still illegal in other parts of the country. But by becoming the ultimate purveyors of cool, musicians like Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, and Louis Armstrong, and phenomenal singers like Bessie Smith and Lena Horne, Harlem managed to create an oasis free from some of those restrictive social norms. Yet despite the many positive things that came out of the Renaissance, some historians remain critical of the movement, accusing Du Bois, Locke, and members of the black bourgeoisie of manufacturing the Renaissance in order to use African-American art as a propaganda tool. They also point out that while many of the Harmon exhibits did bring in crowds, the sales that were supposed to provide a better life for many of their award-winning painters and sculptors never materialized. In fact, many of them were forced to move to Europe or retreat back to their unfulfilling day jobs. Like many artists, they wouldn't be celebrated until they were dead. But though that may be accurate, it's also true that many perceptions, stereotypes, and false narratives about African Americans were debunked during this extraordinary time period. And before the Great Depression put an end to this eruption of black culture, the people of Harlem knew that they hadn't just migrated and settled a city to solely escape Jim Crow. Despite the struggles, hardships, and everything stacked against them by society, they found their artistic voice and made their dreams come true, and had, if only for a while, become all they knew they could be. Now we know that we've only scratched the surface of the Harlem Renaissance with this episode, but we do hope it serves as an inspiration for you to seek out and learn more about these and other amazing artists of the movement. Because while much of their work influenced the American theater, literature, music, and film we all enjoy today, the stories of their lives during this extraordinary time can also serve as an inspiration for new generations of artists to share their own voices. See you next time, everyone. Legendary patron roll call: Ahmed Ziad Turk, Alicia Bramble, Casey Mustia, Dominic Valenciana, Gunnar Clovis, Kyle Murgatroyd, and O'Reels One. Thank you so much.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. That was very interesting. Very interesting. The Harlem Renaissance. And I've got the links in the chat box for those people who want to go in and you know, click on the links for whatever they want to do. But they have some amazing art in there and artwork and everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people can always Google the Harlem Renaissance and they can bring up other things. But, you know, while we're listening and what have you, it's like, okay, give something else to think about and listen to.
Yeah. So you had the early 1900s, the Great Migration, called the New Negro Movement. That's what it was called. And so you had this great migration of people moving north and a lot of them trying to try new things by coming to Harlem because they knew what was going on then. And especially in the 1920s, when this was at the height of what they were doing, what the artistry was all about, took place in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how they mention Oscar Michaud, who we talked about at the beginning of this show, and how he was one of the main artists who took part in the Harlem Renaissance, his films, and all of his work featured in that, in Harlem. And I noticed they mentioned, I don't know if you can Google this, Inez, the Schomburg, I think it's the Schomburg Center of Black History. That's who sponsored this clip. I think it's S-C-H-O-M-B-U-R-G.
Mm-mm.
I think
If it's called in Illinois, it's S-C-H-A-U-M, I think.
Okay.
It's Schomburg. If it's Schomburg, Illinois.
I think they called it the Center for Black History.
The Schomburg Center for the Arts?
For Black History.
It is. It's the Schomburg, and you're right, S-C-H-O-M-B-U-R-G, Center for Research and Black Culture, and that's in New York. So let me type in that way.
Do they have a website?
Well, hold
that's
on.
What you're looking at
one
right
moment,
now.
Please. Yes. The Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, that's what it's called now, is one of the New York public libraries' renowned research libraries and the world's leading cultural institutions devoted to the research, preservation, and exhibition of materials focused on African America, African diaspora, if I say that, diaspora, and African experiences. So, and it's under www.nypl.org, and I'll also put that in the chat room for those of you who would like to look at it, read about it, you know, boom, boom, boom. But yeah, it's interesting, really, really interesting. Let me see here if I can. Okay, now it's going to come up with all this other stuff, but it is, and it's in New York, so that's where a lot of things are, is in New York. Got to go north to find all the fineries and some things in the south. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like how they describe the clothing of the time, what was called a zoot suit.
Oh, the zoot suit?
Z-O-O-T.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the zoot suit that men would wear. And it's pretty iconic what it looks like with the wide, big shoulders and the pants that kind of came down and tapered at the ankles and very wide lapels and tails on the back.
I've made one. I've made
you
one.
You have? You made a zoot suit.
I had to, because I made zoot suits. A purple one with a purple hat and a feather. I sure did.
Uh-huh.
I'm
sure did. So you know what they're talking
as
about.
As a designer that I am. Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the women of that era, I've been in plays, you know, during that era, so I had to dress up as in those type times, and I've made outfits for those times as well. So, yes, I most definitely know about the that era and love the era. Just, you know, some people like it, and don't forget the long chain that the men had for their pocket watches. And they always had a long old chain dangling from the pocket of their pants. I think basically to the different belt loops is what it was. But oh yes, definitely know about that time frame. Definitely know about that time frame and love it.
Right.
And it's very interesting, you know, that we come on with this clothing, then it's taken away from us and, you know, rearranged, changed, and whatever else, but that's okay. That's okay. What were you going to say?
Yeah. Oh, they mentioned a woman named Jora Neale Hurston, and I think we're going to feature her in one of the future shows that we have. That Jora played a big role with the Harlem Renaissance. Yeah.
It's
Jora.
Zora.
Is that Zora. Zora.
Z-O-R-A.
The way I wrote it, I put it, my Z's and J's look the same in cursive. So.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
And she was a filmmaker as well. She was an American author, anthropologist, and filmmaker. And she portrayed racial struggles in the early 1900s American South and published research on hoodoo. So, yeah, hopefully, you always come up and bring these people in. So, and they always seem to, you know, interweave with whatever we've talked about prior to. We talked about W.E.B. Du Bois. We talked about a lot of these people. So how he came up with the Harlem Renaissance and the NAACP. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, I won't say the web we weave, but it's we're all intertwined and tangled up in the same thing. So you can't get out of, I don't want to say, you can't get out of Black history without facing these people somehow, some way. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
So,
and I wish
I mean,
all
no matter
this
who you talk about.
I wish all this was
in
taught
school?
In schools. Mm. Yeah, there definitely
needs to be in schools of black history. You are our teacher. Mm-hmm.
Well, but my hope is
seriously. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
What
were you going to say?
Oh, there needs to be some black history curriculum taught in the schools. There's just too many people that we've talked about in this course of months here. We've gone back months, and all these people that we've talked about, they need to be talked and taught about in the school system to show that there's just as much black history as there is for Caucasians.
As American
history. So that needs to be, as American history. Sorry about that, about the wording there, but.
No, you're fine.
And also.
No, you're fine because, I mean, we may have some pieces in American history, but they don't go into depth, you know, and until you take up black history or black social studies or black economics or black this or black that, you won't get taught it into the depth that it needs to be taught, which is sad, but it's true. You know what I mean? So, you know, you could talk about American history all you want, but there is no American history without the history of including blacks.
Right. I totally
agree.
Plain
and simple. So that's just how that goes.
You know, one thing that you can Google for us is the Cotton Club. You know, the Cotton Club was a pretty iconic place during the Harlem Renaissance. One of the big places in Harlem.
Like in Harlem Nights and everything like that, the Cotton Club.
Cotton Club.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a lot of musicians started.
Okay. I hate when this stuff. Because a lot of times when I go into these sites, just continue to the site. I don't need no help. It says the legendary night spot in the Harlem district of North New York City that for years featured prominent black entertainers who performed for white audiences. The club served as a springboard of fame for Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, and many others. Jack Johnson, the first African-American heavyweight boxing champion, opened the Deluxe Club, a 400-seat nightclub in the corner of 142nd Street in Lenox, which I think I've been to, 51st in Lenox in New York. And this was in the 1920 and 22. The club was taken over by Owen Madden, a well-known Manhattan underworld figure. Madden rechristened the establishment the Cotton Club, limited the audience to white patrons, entirely reworked the interior and turned the club into the most popular cabaret in Harlem. The new 700-seat club offered stimulating surroundings for its nightly reviews by renowned chorus lines. Weekly radio broadcasts spread the fame of the club and its musicians to national audiences. So, you know, that's how that goes. Always taking over.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love the bird in the background.
Isn't it still
I
there?
I love it, love it, love it.
Love what?
Love the bird in the background.
Yeah, he's getting
I
pretty mouthy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's okay. Let me see. Film, how come in 2001? Quizzes. Let me see. Let me go back here. Because it says, one of the questions that's asked on Google says, what is the Cotton Club Harlem Renaissance? How did the Cotton Club affect the Harlem Renaissance? Who started the Cotton Club? And what was the theme of the Cotton Club? So it looks like the Cotton Club is still in effect as of 1923, and it has the dash with no ending. So that was as of 2007.
Still
so it's still there. Yes, it's still there.
Still there.
Still
yeah.
there.
A place to go.
But between, and between the 1923 to 1935, it was whites only, and until it was changed. So that's there. You have it. There you have
okay.
it. Which is, so we're always So that's where we are with that. Yes, it is. It is very interesting.
Yeah.
So people out there, if you want to join us in and chat with us about the Harlem Renaissance, the Cotton Club, anything else you want to know about what we're speaking on tonight, which is the artists who changed changed America, changed history, same thing. But go ahead and call us at 845-241-9985 as we have a caller, Wade, with us. He likes to listen in, which I appreciate you, Wade. And I don't know if you want to say anything as you intently listen to what we're speaking about. You have anything else to say?
No, not at the moment right now. I was just
listening. Okay. I'll come back to you. Good. And I will come back because this is where you're going to find some wonderful black history. And like I said, if you have any questions, I'll, keep coming back to you and see if you have any questions or if there's anybody you maybe want to discuss or maybe even bring in the future. Because we don't just stick to this one thing. We like to bring the information to the people. So if there's something that you're interested, don't hesitate to say, hey, Miss Inez, Miss Janet, I'd like to know more about boom. Or, I heard about boom or something like that. So, then we can include that in our Keeping History Alive segment is what I call it. So that's where we are. So do you have anything else, Ms. Janet, on the Harlem Renaissance?
No. I mean, there's so much you can talk about with it, but this is what a great time. What a great time. So, no, that wraps it up.
Yes. Okay, so I'm going to go into a couple of clips, and then we're going to be back on the flip side. As I said, go ahead and call us at 845-241-9985, or you can click in on the chat room and talk to me and chat with me and say, hey, Miss Inez, love the show, like what you're doing. Can you do more of this? Boom, 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 boom. Or you can, as Mr. Wade did, call us at 845-241-9985. And don't forget to follow us. And then that way you can be in the know about all of our topics and what we speak about throughout the week, Tuesday through Fridays. And on Sundays, as we have our church services on Sundays. So I'm going to play a couple of commercials, and then we'll be back with Miss Janet.
Do you feel the black community needs to be guided in a different way and do different things to improve our community ourselves? Then we would love for you to join our team at doitallinthemall.com to help guide our people to shop where they're important and where their money matters to help develop our communities ourselves. Nationwide, we've done it all, and we can do it again. Join us by going to the website, doitallinthemall.com, and fill out a contact form to be a guide in your community. It's free for you to help guide people in your area to shop where they're important and where their money matters. Let's develop our communities ourselves. Doitallinthemall.com.
Doitallinthemall.com. DoItAllInTheMall.com has partnered with over 5,000 of your favorite stores and businesses nationwide, such as Mary Kay, Avon, Amazon, among many others, to help make a positive impact within our communities. Proceeds from purchases made on DoItAllInTheMall.com are funneled back into the community. Afrocentric, apparel, automotive, beauty, home goods, food, drinks, games, gardening, and so much more at DoItAllInTheMall.com. So what are you waiting for? So come on and do all of your shopping right here in the mall at DoItAllInTheMall.com today.
And that was one of our guest people that we have on Fridays, alternating with Late Night with Lee Alston and Gullah Soul Music. So you can join us this Friday and listen to him 6 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Central, and 9 p.m. Eastern Time. So as we come back on the other side, you're welcome to call in at 845-241-9985. And don't forget to follow us under Let's Do It Radio, down on the homepage of DoItAllInTheMall.com. And who do we have next? Miss Janet from Indiana, who is keeping history alive. I want to say keeping Black history alive, but hopefully she'll also include some other history throughout her you know, throughout time. So right now it's we're doing Black history. So who do we have next on our on tap, as we say?
Well, we have another voice of the Harlem Renaissance, Mr. Langston Hughes. One of the first clips that we're going to listen to is about how he was a leading voice of the Harlem Renaissance. And the second clip is about him being on trial in front of the McCarthy, in the McCarthy era. If you don't know about that, that was called the Red Scare. McCarthy tried to find out who in the United States was a communist. And because being a communist back in that time was taboo, they didn't want you in America at that point. So they questioned whether Mr. Hughes was a communist. And so that second clip is from a transcript of words of Mr. Hughes himself. But let's listen to the first one called The Leading Voice of Harlem Renaissance, Mr. Langston Hughes.
All right.
All right.
Langston Hughes is considered a great author because he spoke to, for, and about Black people in America.
Poet, novelist, and playwright, Langston Hughes was the leading voice of the Harlem Renaissance.
America was changing during the time that Langston Hughes was so popular. Black consciousness was becoming more and more public, more prominent. I think that Langston Hughes was important because he was one of the early figures to show the dignity and the beauty of ordinary Black life.
He was one of the most visible of the younger Black poets, a new generation that described themselves as the new Negro. They covered new topics, took on new poetic forms, and sought a wider audience, and Langston Hughes was at the forefront of that.
James Mercer Langston Hughes was born in Joplin, Missouri on February 1st, 1902. He wrote a lot about being lonely when he was young, and I think that was a tremendous part of the product of moving around so much. After graduating high school, Hughes published his first and most famous poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers.
It is the first poem that celebrates Africa and dignifies the image of Africa in American literature.
The Negro Speaks of Rivers was published in a popular Black journal, and so he was really rather widely read from the beginning.
his poetry and his prose actually had access to everyday people. While studying at Columbia University, Hughes discovered the Harlem art scene, spending hours in jazz and blues clubs, weaving the rhythms of music into his work.
Jazz and blues were great influences on Langston Hughes. He sought to capture the energy and vitality of the music in his poetry.
He was very familiar with the Harlem nightlife. He knew the musicians, and later in his life he would even collaborate with some of the key figures at that time, such as Duke Ellington.
Hughes was a prolific writer and one of the first African-American authors who could support himself through his writing.
Langston Hughes wrote plays. He edited anthologies of poets of African descent across the diaspora. He wrote short stories. One of his most famous series of short stories centers around Jesse B. Simple. These are tales told by a resident of Harlem to an aspiring writer who's a stand-in for Langston Hughes.
He was one of the more widely published of the young poets of the period. He was also among the better connected. He really worked hard to promote the careers of other young writers in Harlem and also throughout the rest of his life. That's also one of his big legacies. Langston Hughes died of cancer on May 22, 1967. His Harlem residence was given landmark status, a fitting tribute for a legendary writer.
His influence, his ambition as a creative writer, his success, his accessibility. He wrote for the average person. He was not writing for college classrooms. He was not writing for the elite. All of those things, I think, require that we recognize and acknowledge him as a great American literary voice of the 20th century.
Interesting. Very interesting. Next one is Langston Hughes on Trial, the McCarthy era American Experience.
Have you ever been a believer in communism?
My feeling, sir, is that I have believed in the entire philosophy of the left at one period in my life, including socialism, communism, Trotskyism. All isms have influenced me one way or another.
Remember writing this. Good morning, revolution. You are the very best friend I've ever had. We are going to pile around together from now on.
Yes, sir, I wrote that.
Did you write this? Put one more S in the USA to make it Soviet. The USA, when we take control, will be the USSA then.
Yes, sir, I wrote that.
Were you kidding when you wrote those things? What did you mean by those?
To give you a full interpretation of any piece of literary work, one has to consider what brought it into being. I, sir, was born a Negro. From my very earliest childhood memories, I have encountered very hurtful problems. One of my earliest memories was going to the movies in Lawrence, Kansas. One afternoon, I put my nickel down and the woman pushed it back and she pointed to a sign. The sign said, "Colored not admitted." It was my first revelation of the division between the American citizens. My playmates, who were white and lived next door to me, could go to that motion picture, and I could not. In the first grade, my mother worked for a lawyer. Being a working woman, naturally she wanted to send me to the nearest school, and they would not let me go to the school. My mother had to go to the school board, and finally, after some time, she got me into the school. I had been there only a few days when the teacher made unpleasant and derogatory remarks about Negroes. Some of my schoolmates stoned me on the way home from school. My father and my mother were not together. When I got old enough to learn why, again, it was the same thing. My father, shortly after I was born, had studied law. He applied for permission to take the bar, and they would not permit him. A Negro evidently could not take the examinations. I missed my father. I learned he had gone away to another country because of prejudice here. When I finally met my father at the age of 17, he said, "Never go back to the United States. Negroes are fools to live there." I didn't believe that. I loved the country I had grown up in. I was concerned with the problems, and I came back here. And so my interest in whatever may be considered political has been born out of this whole problem of myself, segregated, poor, colored, and how I can adjust to this whole problem of helping to build America when sometimes I cannot even get into a school or a lecture or a concert or in the South go to the library and get a book out.
Could you make it briefer, please?
A critical work goes out of a very deep background. It does not come in a moment. I am perfectly willing to come back and give it to you later if you are tired.
No, we will sit here as long as you want to go on, but you are missing the point completely. Will you give us some straightforward answers? Did you ever in your life desire the Soviet form of government over here? That is a very simple question, Mr. Hughes, for a man who wrote the things you did, and we have just got it.
And one thing about that, it talks about democracy is a what he had written, and some words from that was, democracy will not come today, this year, nor ever through compromise and fear. Freedom is a strong seed planted in a great need. I live here too. I want freedom, just as you. From Langston Hughes, 1949. So, yes, yes. And we, everybody wants the same thing. We just want to be free and let us do what we want to do. We're not trying to hurt nobody. Well, some people might be trying to hurt somebody, but, you know.
Yeah, he was the leading voice of the Harlem Renaissance, supported himself.
He was.
His writings and his speeches and books, just focusing on the dignity.
Things.
Yeah, focusing on the dignity and beauty of black life. Again, wanting to show people that the black people are dignified and they have a lot to offer to the nation. So that's what he was all about. And it was just interesting to see all the racism. I mean, when he was growing up, his mother going before the school board saying, "Listen, you're going to take my son into your school and let him be a part of that and
learn."
Right. And then, but within days, the teacher was saying some very disparaging things, and some of the classmates stoned him on the way home from school. So, gee whiz, that had to be some serious trials, and it would make me not want to come back to school. And trauma, sure.
And it's just crazy because that reminds me of that movie, A Time to Kill, where those guys did that. What they did that little girl, that just
they did a lot to her.
And I mean, that's the life that we had to, not we have to live, but we live, you know, and the things that we had to endure, you know, just to stay alive. I mean, get stoned, spat on, whipped, chained, lynched, abused, misused, you know, cattle called, you know, just burnt, you know, whipped, just everything. It's just like, we're people just like you. Why do you want to do so wrong? And he was light-skinned, so it's not like he was, you know, in the heat of the night black. You know, he was light-skinned, but yet, you know, he had, I guess, the features of a black person. So, therefore, you know, they did to him what they did to him.
Right.
Which is wrong. I was just told it wrong, but that's what we had to do her. You know.
And he was such an influence that he got called before the Senate Congressional Committee of McCarthy and for his views. And I mean, it just shows you how much they were afraid of him and his influence and what kind of views that he had. They knew the kind of influence that he had through the Harlem Renaissance and just as a voice for black people to the point where they had to call him and question him before a committee, a Senate committee. We have Langston Hughes. Were you Googling something while we were discussing?
You know, I'm always Googling something.
I always
Google
Googling
Mama and stuff.
Okay, what'd you find out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just the things that he just went through. You know, he lived with his grandmother. I don't know if that was said, but. Langston Hughes grew up in a series of Midwestern small towns, and his father left the family soon after he was a boy. He was born and later divorced the mom, Carrie. The senior, Hughes traveled to Cuba and then Mexico seeking escape, like he said, you know, during the racism in the United States. And after the separation, Hughes and others traveled seeking employment. Langston was raised mainly in Lawrence, Kansas, by a maternal grandmother, and through the Black America oral tradition and drawing from the activist experience of her generation, Mary Langston instilled in her grandson a lasting sense of racial pride. But I want to say I think he was gay as well. I think he was gay.
Okay.
And I think that came out later. It says, imbued by his grandmother with a duty to help his race, Hughes identified with neglected and downtrodden black people all his life and glorified them in his work. So he, you know, talked about them. In his autobiography in 1940, The Big C, he wrote, I was unhappy for a long time and very lonesome living with my grandmother. Then it was that books began to happen to me, and I began to believe in nothing but books and the wonderful world in books. Where people suffered, they suffered in beautiful language, not in monosyllables, as we did in Kansas. So what he wrote was colorful. What he wrote was colorful. So that was interesting. That was very interesting. So yes. Okay, he was. He says, sexuality. Some academics and biographers believe that Hughes was homosexual and included homosexual codes in many of his poems, as did Walt Whitman, who, Hughes said, influenced his poetry. Hughes' story, Blessed Assurance, deals with the father's anger over his son's effeminacy and queerness. The biographer, Aldrich, argues that in order to retain the respect and support of black churches and organizations and avoid exacerbating his precarious financial situation, he has remained closeted.
Closeted.
He just remained how he was. And that's the word. I couldn't say it. Closeted. So, you know, it was hard, you know, first being black. And then being, you know, of his sexual orientation, you know, he was just ridiculed and just, you know, hurt. So he had to, you know, he had a lot of unpublished poems about a lot of things. So if anybody wants to Google and look up Langston Hughes, he had written a lot of material. So we encourage you to delve into your, quote unquote, your history, and that you don't just have to be black, you can be, you know, whatever color, and just read about what we went through, what we endured. And if you're out there and want us to talk about your race, please let us know. You can call us 845-241-9985. You can chat with me in the chat room. You can follow us. You can contact us through the contact us information. Say, hey, I want you to speak about this. I want you to speak about that. But, you know, we don't want to exclude anybody, you know, if there's something that we can get out as a positive influence to our worldwide listeners, because we do have listeners all over. We got people from everywhere. Brazil, Portugal, Ethiopia, Africa, Lagos, Russia, everywhere. So no matter, Colombia. So, you know, we appreciate you all listening to us and listening to what we're going through. So, and then one day, Miss Janet is going to talk about her heritage, hopefully. Yes, no, maybe so.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I've got an interesting heritage, that's for sure.
Hey,
my particular
and that's,
family
that's what we're
has
about,
a,
you know.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
okay.
I can,
it's still part of history.
Right, right. Yeah. I'm just thinking about the stories I can tell. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. That's a whole year's worth of stuff, right?
That's right. That's right.
That's a whole.
Oh, brother.
I'm
yeah.
just saying. That's just a whole. That's a whole. But it is. It's good to hear about just not one, you know, one thing, but everything, because that's how we live. That's how we endure. That's how we learn, is just going about everything and learning about history. It doesn't matter what history it is still history. It is still history. So what else do you have for us about Langston?
Oh,
anything else?
Langston.
Any other
no,
juice?
That's pretty...
Any other juice? Yeah.
No, I think we covered it all. We've covered it all.
Okay.
So this next person is very interesting.
But before
Ethel
we do,
Waters.
I'm going to go to.
Go ahead.
But before we go to Ethel, I'm going to go to Wade and see if he has anything to say. Like I said, I was going to go back to him and see if he has anything to say about Mr. Langston Hughes. So, Wade, do you have anything you'd like to say or any comments? Are you just listening? Wade? He must be just listening. So we appreciate him listening as well. So we're going to go into a commercial, one that somebody loves to death. We won't say which one it is, and then another one.
I was wondering.
Love lower than low prices? Then get more ways to save at Kroger, where you can find personalized coupons, weekly deals, and rewards like fuel points. All for prices that are lower than low. On food that's fresher than fresh. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
And Kroger can be found under the food and drink section under Do It All in the Mall. Or you can type in Kroger and go directly to the Kroger tab. And Kroger is also going to be in the Florida area. I've been hearing commercial that Kroger's coming to Florida. So you Florida natives, Kroger is coming to an area near you, maybe. So this low commercial can be heard, and you'll say, yes, we love the low prices of Lowe's. And now we hope you're shopping. Do you do it all?
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you are shopping at doitallinthemall.com. Why? Because a percentage of the proceeds will go back into our communities and help redevelop those same communities, making our lives better. Women and men have been coming together by shopping to make a difference in our communities. And won't you join us today? Again, shop doitallinthemall.com.
Yes, and who is next up on our tab, Miss Janet?
Well, we're going to end this out with Miss Ethel Waters. We have a fairly large clip to listen to, and you talk about someone who had a full life. I couldn't even keep up taking notes on her from this clip, so I couldn't. She did so many things. My goodness. So let's go ahead and listen to this movie star biography of Ethel Waters.
All right, here we go. So while you're listening, go ahead and shop to doitallinthemall.com or just take a look, peruse, you know. You don't want to shop today. It's not going anywhere. It's just, you know, so you can always click on Do It All in the Mall and shop to your heart's content.
Ethel Waters, October 31, 1896, September 1, 1977, was an American singer and actress. Waters frequently performed jazz, swing, and pop music on the Broadway stage and in concerts. She began her career in the 1920s singing blues. Waters' notable recordings include Dinah, Stormy Weather, Taking a Chance on Love, Heat Wave, Supper Time, Am I Blue? Cabin in the Sky, I'm Coming Virginia, and her version of His Eye is on the Sparrow. Waters was the second African American to be nominated for an Academy Award. She was the first African American to star on her own television show and the first African American woman to be nominated for a Primetime Emmy Award. Waters was born in Chester, Pennsylvania on October 31, 1896. Some sources state her birth year is 1900, as a result of the rape of her teenaged African American mother, Louise Anderson, 1881 to 1962, by John Waters, 1878 to 1901, a pianist and family acquaintance from a middle-class African-American background. Waters' family was very fair-skinned, her mother in particular. Many sources, including Ethel herself, have reported for years that her mother was 12 or 13 years old at the time of the rape, 13 when Ethel was born. Stephen Bourne opens his 2007 biography, Ethel Waters, Stormy Weather, with the statement that genealogical research has shown that she may have been in her late teens. Waters played no role in raising Ethel. Soon after she was born, her mother married Norman Howard, a railroad worker. Ethel used the surname Howard as a child and then reverted to her father's name. She was raised in poverty by Sally Anderson, her grandmother, who worked as a housemaid, and with two of her aunts and an uncle. Waters never lived in the same place for more than 15 months. Of her difficult childhood, she said, I never was a child. I never was cuddled, or liked, or understood by my family. Waters grew tall, standing 5 feet 9.5 inches, 1.765 meters, in her teens. According to jazz historian and archivist Rosetta Wright, Waters' birth in the North and her peripatetic life exposed her to many cultures. Waters married at the age of 13, but her husband was abusive, and she soon left the marriage and became a maid in a Philadelphia hotel, working for $4.75 per week. On her 17th birthday, she attended a costume party at a nightclub on Juniper Street. She was persuaded to sing two songs and impress the audience so much that she was offered professional work at the Lincoln Theater in Baltimore. She recalled that she earned the rich sum of $10 per week, but her managers cheated her out of the tips her admirers threw on the stage. After her start in Baltimore, Waters toured on the black vaudeville circuit, in her words, from 9 until unconscious. Despite her early success, she fell on hard times and joined a carnival traveling in freight cars headed for Chicago. She enjoyed her time with the carnival and recalled, the roustabouts and the concessionaires were the kind of people I'd grown up with, rough, tough, full of larceny towards strangers, but sentimental and loyal to their friends and co-workers. But she did not last long with them and soon headed south to Atlanta, where she worked in the same club as Bessie Smith. Smith demanded that Waters not compete in singing blues opposite her. Waters conceded and sang ballads and popular songs. Around 1919, Waters moved to Harlem and became a performer in the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. Her first Harlem job was at Edmund Cellar, a club with a black patronage that specialized in popular ballads. She acted in a blackface comedy, Hello 1919. Jazz historian Rosetta Wrights pointed out that by the time Waters returned to Harlem in 1921, women blues singers were among the most powerful entertainers in the country. In 1921, Waters became the fifth black woman to make a record for Tiny Cardinal Records. She later joined Black Swan, where Fletcher Henderson was her accompanist. Waters later commented that Henderson tended to perform in a more classical style than she preferred, often lacking the damn it to hell bass. She recorded for Black Swan from 1921 through 1923. Her contract with Harry Pace made her the highest-paid black recording artist at the time. In early 1924, Paramount bought Black Swan, and she stayed with Paramount through the year. She first recorded for Columbia in 1925, achieving a hit with Dinah. She started working with Pearl Wright, and they toured in the South. In 1924, Waters played at the Plantation Club on Broadway. She also toured with the Black Swan Dance Masters. With Earl Dancer, she joined what was called the White Time Keith Vaudeville Circuit, a vaudeville circuit performing for white audiences and combined with screenings of silent movies. They received rave reviews in Chicago and earned the unheard-of salary of $1,250 in 1928. In September 1926, Waters recorded I'm Coming Virginia, composed by Donald Haywood with lyrics by Will Marion Cook. She is often wrongly attributed as the author. The following year, Waters sang it in a production of Africana at Broadway's Daly's 63rd Street Theater. In 1929, Waters and Wright arranged the unreleased Harry Ax song Am I Blue?, which was used in the movie On With the Show and became a hit and her signature song. In 1933, Waters appeared in a satirical all-black film, Rufus Jones for President, which featured the child performer Sammy Davis Jr. as Rufus Jones. She went on to star at the Cotton Club, where, according to her autobiography, she sang Stormy Weather from the depths of the private hell in which I was being crushed and suffocated. In 1933, she had a featured role in the successful Irving Berlin Broadway musical Revue as Thousands Cheer with Clifton Webb, Marilyn Miller, and Helen Broderick. She became the first black woman to integrate Broadway's theater district more than a decade after Charles Gilpin's critically acclaimed performances in the plays of Eugene O'Neill beginning with The Emperor Jones in 1920. Waters held three jobs, in as Thousands Cheer, as a singer for Jack Denny and his orchestra on a national radio program, and in nightclubs. She became the highest-paid performer on Broadway. Despite this status, she had difficulty finding work. She moved to Los Angeles to appear in the 1942 film Cairo. During the same year, she reprised her starring stage role as Petunia in the all-black film musical Cabin in the Sky directed by Vincente Minnelli, and starring Lena Horne as the Ingenue. Conflicts arose when Minnelli swapped songs from the original script between Waters and Horne. Waters wanted to perform Honey in the Honeycomb as a ballad, but Horne wanted to dance to it. Horne broke her ankle and the songs were reversed. She got the ballad and Waters the dance. Waters sang the Academy Award-nominated Happiness is Just a Thing Called Joe. In 1939, Waters became the first African-American to star in her own television show, before the debut of Nat King Cole's in 1956. The Ethel Waters Show, a 15-minute variety special, appeared on NBC on June 14, 1939. It included a dramatic performance of the Broadway play Mamba's Daughters, based on the Gullah community of South Carolina and produced with her in mind. The play was based on the novel by DuBose Hayward. Waters was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for the film Pinky, 1949, under the direction of Aaliyah Kazan after the first director, John Ford, quit over disagreements with Waters. According to producer Daryl F. Zanuck, Ford hated that old woman, Waters. Ford, Kazan stated, didn't know how to reach Ethel Waters. Kazan later referred to Waters as truly odd combination of old-time religiosity and free-flowing hatred. In 1950, she won the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for her performance opposite Julie Harris in the play The Member of the Wedding. Waters and Harris repeated their roles in the 1952 film version. In 1950, Waters was the first African-American actress to star in a television series, Beulah, which aired on ABC Television from 1950 through 1952. It was the first nationally broadcast weekly television series starring an African-American in the leading role. She starred as Beulah for the first year of the TV series before quitting in 1951, complaining that the portrayal of blacks was degrading. She was replaced by Louise Beavers in the second and third season. She guest starred in 1957 and 1959 on NBC's The Ford Show, starring Tennessee Ernie Ford. In a 1957 segment, she sang Cabin in the Sky. When production moved to Hollywood, Hattie McDaniel, star of Radio's Beulah from 1947 to 1952, was cast in the title role in summer 1951, but she only filmed six shows before falling ill. She was quickly replaced by Louise Beavers in later 1951. The McDaniel episodes were shelved pending an improvement of her health, and so the second season began in April 1952 starting with the Beavers episodes. The six McDaniel episodes were tagged onto the end of the second season, starting in July 1952 and running until August 1952. It was around this time that McDaniel learned that she had advanced breast cancer. Beavers returned in the role of Beulah for the first part of the third Beulah season, which aired from September to December 1952. Her first autobiography, His Eye is on the Sparrow, 1951, written with Charles Samuels, was adapted for the stage by Larry Parr and premiered on October 7, 2005. In 1953, she appeared in a Broadway show, At Home with Ethel Waters, that opened on September 22, 1953 and closed October 10 after 23 performances. Waters married three times and had no children. When she was 13, she married Merritt Buddy Pernsley in 1909. They divorced in 1913. During the 1920s, Waters was involved in a romantic relationship with dancer Ethel Williams. The two were dubbed the Two Ethels and lived together in Harlem. She married Clyde Edwards Matthews in 1929, and they divorced in 1933. She married Edward Mallory in 1938, they divorced in 1945. Waters was the great-aunt of the singer-songwriter Crystal Waters. In 1938, Waters met artist Luigi Lucioni through their mutual friend, Carl Van Vechten. Lucioni asked Waters if he could paint her portrait, and a sitting was arranged at his studio at 64 Washington Square South. Waters bought the finished portrait from Lucioni in 1939 for $500. She was at the height of her career and the first African-American to have a starring role on Broadway. In her portrait, she wore a tailored red dress with a mink coat draped over the back of her chair. Lucioni positioned Waters with her arms tightly wrapped around her waist, a gesture that conveyed vulnerability, as if she were trying to protect herself. The painting was considered lost because it had not been seen in public since 1942. Huntsville, Alabama, Museum of Art Executive Director Christopher J. Madcore and historian Stuart Embury traced it to a private residence. By 1955, Waters was deeply in debt for back taxes. The IRS seized royalties of her work. She lost tens of thousands in jewelry and cash in a robbery. Her health suffered, and she worked sporadically. Yet she had faced lean times before. A turning point came in 1957 when she attended the Billy Graham Crusade in Madison Square Garden. She entered the garden that night a disillusioned, lonely, 61-year-old woman. She had become successful at giving out happiness, but her personal life lacked peace. She was in debt, had physical problems, weighed too much to perform comfortably, and was worried about her career. Years later, she gave this testimony of that night. In 1957, I, Ethel Waters, a 380-pound decrepit old lady, rededicated my life to Jesus Christ, and boy, because he lives, just look at me now. I tell you because he lives, and because my precious child, Billy, gave me the opportunity to stand there, I can thank God for the chance to tell you his eye is on all of us sparrows. In her later years, Waters often toured with the preacher Billy Graham on his crusades. Waters died on September 1, 1977, aged 80, from uterine cancer, kidney failure, and other ailments, in Chatsworth, California. She is buried at Forest Lawn Memorial Park, Glendale. Ethel was written and performed by Terry Burrell as a one-woman tribute to Waters. It ran as a limited engagement in February and March 2012.
Interesting woman. She's been through a lot.
Born of rape.
But she endured.
Her mother was raped, and that's what that's the product of what happened is Ethel. And what that's a beginning. Okay. Yeah.
And look how great she is.
Exactly. Look what God can take from a bad situation and bring about good. Like the Bible says,
exactly.
He takes all things for the good. And that's one big example. Yeah. She was fair-skinned, and we've talked about this several times before, that it seems like the fair-skinned ones seem to make it farther or had more of an advantage than the others with darker skin. So
Yes.
I don't know. That could have played a role in her life. My guess is yes, it probably did to some extent. But look at all her accomplishments. My goodness.
That's
I couldn't keep
about.
Up with taking
yes.
notes. Like I said, I couldn't keep
How many
up
times
taking
you listen
notes
to this
on this
clip.
Right.
But she was a beautiful woman, though.
Uh-huh.
She kind of reminds me of Josephine Baker. So, I mean, they could
yeah.
almost portray each other, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
Really, in essence,
oh,
they
yeah.
sure could. They sure
right.
could.
Right.
Wow.
They, I believe they knew each other and were, I think she was friends with Josephine Baker. Not quite sure. I'm going to have to look back at that, look back at my notes. Anyway, let me
you
go
know
back
me.
Here.
I'm Miss Google Meister.
Right, Miss Google Meister. Okay, yeah, they were contemporaries, and I'm sure they were friends,
mm-hmm.
Josephine Baker and Ethel Waters. I believe they might have done some work together, excuse me, and because she was mentioned when in one of the clips that we listened to on Josephine Baker,
mm-hmm.
Ethel Waters was mentioned in that clip. So they
yes.
had worked together, I believe, and were contemporaries. So
mm.
yeah.
Mm. Mm.
What an accomplished woman.
Mm.
To be the first, actually
and
the second African-American
so
to be nominated.
Right.
Right. She was the second African-American to be nominated for an Academy Award. So
mm-hmm.
my
mm-hmm.
guess is that the first one had to be Hattie Daniels.
That's
anyway,
what I'm thinking. I was going to say that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
So
and
what
she
was
got married at age...
Josephine Baker nominated for? She was nominated
first,
for something. She was the first woman who
nominated for an Academy Award. If you want
Academy,
to Google that
okay,
for us.
Okay, gotcha.
If you want to Google that
okay.
for us and see what film that was
okay.
for.
For Ethel?
Yeah, Ethel Waters.
Okay.
What's her filmography if it mentions that? Here she goes.
Ethel Waters filmography.
Mm-hmm.
Da, 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 da.
Does it have anything?
Oh, they got plenty. I'm just trying to figure out. Among Waters' films was Cairo. Pinky was one of them. She was nominated for which she was nominated for an Academy Award.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen Pinky.
So.
Mm-hmm.
How was it?
Pinky's very good, very good. It's about you'd think that she's white. They had a white woman in the
uh-huh.
role of Pinky. That's her name. But she has
uh-huh.
a black heritage. One of her parents, I believe it was the father, was black. And so when Pinky came home, the character played by Ethel Waters was telling Pinky, you know, you have to acknowledge your background and acknowledge
mm-hmm.
your heritage. You
your
cannot
heritage.
Just run away.
Uh-huh.
You cannot just run away from it. So it's a very good movie. Very good.
Mm.
Pinky is.
I think
is
you've probably
the,
seen more things than I have.
Right.
Have you heard of Mildred Bailey and Bessie Smith?
I'm not sure. I've heard of Bessie Smith, yes.
Okay, cool. Because Mildred Bailey, I'm looking at some more information, was especially influenced by Ethel Waters and Bessie Smith. It was one of the first non-black performers to become a skilled jazz singer. So I don't mm-hmm. think she was black, but she was non-black. But still, all
mm-hmm.
these people who we influenced to become, you know, what they are today or were in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. That is so,
right.
But you know me, I'm going to have to find Pinky and
yeah.
and watch that
yeah.
movie. Mm-hmm.
Wow. This, yeah. I mean, I just love how you always bring this information to us. It's straightforward. It's, you know, you know, a lot. It's filling. It's, you know, things that we should know. And a lot of us, because I'm still, you know, the birth of a nation, I haven't seen that. And my cousin said, well, you haven't seen the birth of a nation? I said, nope.
Mm-mm. I don't think I want to see it. I've never seen it, but I've seen clips of it. Excuse me? What'd you say?
It's not nice? I said, and it's
not
nice?
Well, it has a lot of the Ku Klux Klan in it fighting blacks. Uh-huh. So, I mean, they got film of, it shows the Klan on their horses riding through the woods and in their white garb and their white hoods. And I don't know. It's just something I don't really want to watch. But
nothing you want to be a part of.
Maybe I should.
I'm not a part of that.
No. Maybe I should watch it.
As my grandson, I would watch it, you know, and because you may get something out of it. And maybe we could discuss the birth of a nation one night. If it's not too, you know, too gut-wrenching or too pulling or tale-telling. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can discuss movie night, you know, maybe bring out a movie we could discuss or something. That could be, we could discuss Pinky as well and some of the other movies that, or maybe discuss a few movies of some of these people. Like among Walters' other films, Cairo from 1942, Pinky, which he was nominated for an Academy Award, The Sound and the Fury, and then our autobiography, His Eyes on the Sparrow, was a bestseller. So, you know, some of these things that we could maybe talk about as we talk about these people, say, okay, tonight we're going to talk about the accomplishments of Ethel Waters or Langston Hughes, because I'd like to go more into Langston Hughes myself. I really, that's me, I guess, that I could do that. But you bring up these as teasers, and it's like, oh, maybe we can talk about more about these people and go into detail in depth and things. So that might be something cool too. Tonight, Ethel Waters.
Sure.
Tomorrow, boom boom.
Right.
You know, so that's a thought. You know, that's a thought we could say. Hey. But no, that was interesting. She was an interesting woman. And that 13 minutes didn't, you know, that was, didn't seem very long, so that was a very telltelling part of her. But she goes into some depth, though, into some and some real depth. But no, just always, you always bring some magnificent people to us. And
thank you.
I should rename this. Keep it, you know, because you usually bring Black history, but I mean, like I was saying earlier, maybe you should just bring all. That's why I say just keeping history alive, because we all make history of some sort.
Right.
We're all the melting pot, and we just need to know. We just need to know history, period, because it wasn't taught properly to us in school. And, you know, my mouth is like gaped open because, like, wow, you know. All this information that I didn't know about or didn't dive into myself or find out myself. So I just appreciate every time you bring history to us. And you can always go to Episodes on Demand under Let's Do It Radio for all of the other episodes that Janet has brought to us. And she's brought some banging episodes too. So just go to doitallinthemall.com, and on the right-hand side is Let's Do It Radio, and you can click on the Let's Do It Radio banner, and then you can see, maybe I might listen to this. And because a lot of people did listen to the Juneteenth tribute and celebration. So I don't know if you did, Janet, but a lot of people did listen to that. And I really appreciate those listeners who tuned in and clicked on it and listened to it. And maybe I didn't do it justice, but I did, you know, I tried to bring something to us achieving that goal as being freed and bringing it into Congress, bringing it into as a holiday. So, you know, so June 19th is now a holiday. Whatever day it falls on, it is now a holiday. So we have something else to look forward to each year. So Well, that is wonderful. That is just thank you, thank you. Of course, thank you, of course, as always. So I'm going to bring in Wade to see if he has anything to say about Miss Ethel Waters. So, Wade, do you have any comments you'd like to say about any of the that you heard tonight?
No, not at the moment.
He's out. Not at the moment. So he's our listening man. So we do appreciate you calling in and listening, you know, hanging out with us on the line and, you know, just being there because, you know, you didn't have to. You could be doing something else. So as a commercial said, hope you're shopping or hope you're at least looking through doitallinthemall.com and seeing what's out there because we got things for men, men's apparel, home, Depot. We got Lowe's. We got Ace Hardware. We got the auto store. We have books. We have LegalZoom, we have, you know, just even looking at the tabs, Afrocentric stuff. So to all of our worldwide listeners, if there's something out there you'd like for us to bring into the mall, please let us know by going to the homepage and hitting on the contact us information, and we can bring it in there. I mean, you know, for all we know, Wade may have a product out there that he says, hey, can you add this as I might be Wade in the water, you know, photography for all you know. So, you know, that type. I'm just saying as a for instance, maybe not for real, but, you know, he may have something out there that he'd like to bring into the mall. So are you all out there listening? Let us know if you have a product you'd like to bring into the mall, but or maybe even be on one of our shows and talk about what you do or what maybe your product or some interaction that you've had at some point in time. So don't hide. Don't be shy. So, you know, you guys are more than welcome. You can either call us at 845-241-9985 during the show or just go and hit the chat button or contact us at doitallinthemall@yahoo.com as well. So is there anything else you'd like to talk about this evening, Miss Janet?
No, that's it. That wraps it all up.
That's it for the
great
evening.
Show.
And do you have
that's
yes, excellent show. Do you have a topic for our next show?
Not yet. Nope,
not yet. Okay, so
not
you all
yet.
Stay tuned and listen and hit that follow button, like I said, under Facebook and follow us, and you'll find out exactly what she will be talking about. And then she comes back to us in 2 weeks, and she brings the most interesting history during her Keeping It Alive segment. So we want to thank Miss Janet as we take you to commercial, and
you're
then
welcome.
We'll take us out.
Thank we
you,
do
Wade.
Not own the rights to any information or music you hear at Let's Do It Radio.
Thank you, Miss Rhonda. She also sits out there, Miss Rhonda Anderson Gardner. She sits out there behind the scenes and listens to us. And she's one of my quiet people, but I do appreciate her hanging out with me. So as I'm going to play this, School Is Out. School Is Out. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in with us this evening. And you have been listening to Let's Do a Radio sponsored by doitallinthemall.com as well as all of our other past shows and episodes, which you can listen to episodes on demand. And thank you, Ms. Janet Schwartz, our historian, for keeping history alive and the topic of the artist who changed history. And tonight we talked about Oscar Michaud, Langston Hughes, the Harlem Renaissance, Josephine Baker, and Ethel Waters. And we want to stay tuned to see who she brings to us in 2 weeks. Miss Janet brings the reality to us front and center to Let's Do It Radio listeners worldwide on history and keeping history alive. And we are still keeping history alive as part of our future and as part of our past. And we have to become advocates and advocates by taking our future into our own hands. It doesn't matter who you are and what nationality you are. It's still history. So it seems like the circle of learning continues. As a big shout out to all of our callers, Mr. Wade for joining us again this evening, and Miss Rhonda, as she's also on the line, and our worldwide listening audience and supporting Let's Do It Radio. And every time we Have to keep history alive episodes, I learn something new, something exciting, and something that makes me go, I didn't know about that, or thank you for bringing it to our attention. And if you miss any of the episodes, as I stressed before, or you want to hear an episode or share an episode, you can do so by going to the homepage of doitallinthemall.com and go to Let's Do a Radio banner and check out the episodes on demand. So thank you, Miss Janet Schwartz. Do It All in the Mall is a safe and secure 24/7 online shopping mall providing over 5,000 of your favorite stores, as well as stores you may not be familiar with. So visit, take a tour, and shop for anything you need while listening to entertainment wherever you may be. And make Do It All in the Mall your shopping headquarters for all seasons. It's so easy. You just go there, click on a store that you know, go to it, and it's just like going to the store, but we get a commission. We earn a commission off of going to the to Do It All in the Mall. So please stop and support us, and donations are welcome as well by clicking the donate button on the homepage of course, doitallinthemall.com. And contact us. You can do that by hitting the contact us information on the homepage as well. And the old-fashioned way, by calling us as 509-406-6920 or 813-900-7911. Or you can even hit us up on the chat session during the episode. So please Skype, tune in, listen, talk with us at 845-241-9985, Tuesdays through Fridays, with the following shows that you heard this evening. Miss Janet, Keeping History Alive, 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Eastern, and that's Tuesdays. And Dr. Steele, he will be with us next Tuesday. He's our structured settlement broker who speaks on Think Wealth, and he has the Wealth Think Bank, and his time is the same as Janet, 3 p.m., 4 p.m., 5 p.m., 6 p.m. Eastern. And Wednesdays we have Reverends Carolyn and Rodney McCullough with Bible study, but they will not be doing Bible study tomorrow. I'm going to be playing something special, which I did not play this Sunday, which is a tribute to our fathers, which I'm so sorry I did not get to, but we are going to play this tomorrow, a tribute to our fathers, so everybody tune in. And Wednesday evening next week is Stephanie Lott Whitfield, Why Does Love Hurt? And her session is 6 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Central, and 9 p.m. Eastern. And hanging out with Sergeant Parks, he's going to keep it real this week at 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Mountain, and 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern. He's going to be bringing some of the history of black music to us this week. And we have alternating Fridays. This week we have Late Night with Lee Alston, Gullah Soul Music. As you heard, the Gullah experience on one of our clips this evening out of South Carolina. He is speaking to us from Freeport, Texas, and he is internationally known and talented. Gullah Soul Music, he does soul, jazz, spiritual, and spoken word. And his time is 6 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Central, and 9 p.m. Eastern. And he alternates with Harry Whaley, Vitiligo Man of Action. And this month is World Vitiligo Day. And the 25th of June is that day, as it celebrates the death of Michael Jackson. So they dubbed that Vitiligo World Day. So please tune in to Vitiligo World Day. And you can Google that. It's Vitiligo World Day. BWD something. I've been Googling all night. Why don't I just Google that? But it's Vitiligo World Day. And it is out of Bloomington, Minnesota this week. And I think it's a weekend full of activity. So Vitiligo World Day. Okay. is this week, like I said, the 25th of June. It means that people across the world come together to increase awareness of vitiligo, the Vitiligo Research Foundation, spreading awareness of vitiligo. So please join in. Vitiligo is, World Day is, like I said, the 25th of June. So please go into Vitiligo World Day and just Google 25thjune.org and you can see what's going on that day. And so please help them celebrate and become aware of vitiligo because it is imminent throughout the United States, throughout the whole world. So please, please, please help them celebrate their day. And his day usually is alternating Fridays, and it's 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Eastern. Sunday, we have guest speakers. The first Sunday, Reverend Carolyn McCullough. Second Sunday, Dr. Ralph Steele. Third Sunday, Reverend Carolyn Williamson. Fourth Sunday, this week, we have Ronnie Marshall, Reverend Ronnie Marshall. And on fifth Sundays, which we don't have a lot, is Reverend Heather Lynn Andrews. And you can check out any of the episodes, like I said, on Episodes On Demand through the homepage of Do It All On The Mall under the banner of Let's Do It Radio. So please share this information with everyone you know on social media. Spread the word. The bigger the crowd, the bigger the spectrum. Do Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, anything. Any of your social media. So please, please, please. So thank you for listening to Let's Do It Radio. To Do It All In The Mall. And this has been your hostess for the evening, broadcasting to you worldwide, Miss Inez, owner and fashion designer of On Ice Alco Designs, and where myself, along with all of our entrepreneurs who I spoke about, are on the homepage of Do It All In The Mall under the client section. So as we learned this evening about the artists who changed history, we need to be reminded we can all change history and make a carbon print of our own. So join us in 2 weeks when Miss Janet brings more on keeping history alive. So please have a good evening as I play Lights, Camera, Action Remix. Yes, sir.
Big dog. Yeah. One shot, big dog. Yeah. One shot, big dog. This is the remix. When I come through the door, I'm on the floor, you wanna see my shit, yeah.
Remix.
And when I move it around, you in the corner like that. How she do that deal?
Remix.
It's the beat in the meantime. See, I'm a crime, I keep the crowd jumping.
Remix.
It's the haters that hate the game and talking loud, they ain't saying nothing.
Remix.
Mr. Chief, Big Dog, my boy, they put it heavy on the chisel.
Remix.
Rap. High hat, bass line, but boom, boom, boom. Rap, rap, bit that.
Remix.
It's the remix. God dang it, don't get no better.
Remix.
Y'all suckers and busters being fly too, too. You better get up.
Turn it around, let me see you something. Go with me, it's a little gonna be something. I'm talking like camera action. Have me singing on a solid action. Turn it around, let me see you something. Go with me, it's a little gonna be something. Hey, man, I'm talking like camera action.
One, two, one, two. Time for some action. Cameras flashing everywhere, main attraction. They react like I'm one of the Jacksons. I guess it's just my name that attracts them.
Remix.
World famous, TV. I moved in, I live on TV.
Remix.
And I stay on your radio station, cause I'm placed in heavy rotation.
Remix.
Now let's shake to this. How much noise can you make to this? I like the sound of that. Tell the bartender, send another round of that.
Remix.
I don't know where they found you at. Just keep moving around like that. Take it to the ground and back. Oh, she's serious. Now turn around one time, I'm curious. Yeah, this is the remix. Come on now.
That come through with the crew, hit the ball, such a rope.
Remix,
yo, I bet when the world get a load of this head, they be like, oh, remix, yeah.
The type of joint that make a nigga wanna take a chick back to the telly kid remix. So, big things, Mr. Chick C. Diddy and Missy Elliott remix. Yo, I got my bottle of Mo, my double shot of Jack, and I play the background remix. Yo, until I see a something that I'm really wanting, and I go and lay my mat down, remix. Oh, the dance floor back, we on the table and we bounce on the seat too. Now you understand what big mix and hot lyrics and beats do. Hey, yo.
Damn. If I ain't on the track, I'm Mr. Cheeks and the M to the S.I.E. Spittin' 16 360 degrees from Carolina, Mr. P to P. Take a shoot off, spin it one time for me. Turn around, get your feet on, demons in the bees. Love those who got love for me. Hold those, they be holding me. Then you down, down, all the way down to the ground with me. Get the bar, next round on me. Get drunk, it's all love. I ain't about to take them in face. Bob on the start, Miss Jackson beat. Got a whole club in heat. Shorty, you a Mr. Jack the Freak. Stick your tongue out.
Hey. Shorty, turn it around, let me see you something. Go with me, the rhythm's gonna be fun. I'm talking like Kevin Action. Let me sing it out, sorry, let me catch me. Turn it around, let me see you something. Go with me, the rhythm's gonna be fun.
And due to a little bit of technical difficulty, we're back with Spotlight. As a lot of our artists have been in the spotlight, and the spotlight is done by Miss Jennifer Hudson.
Are you a god in a prison, maximum security?
the spotlight. I'm going to be playing some other songs of artists who changed history or made history or in part of history. Good old Barry White, Never Gonna Give You Up, with his deep voice.
Never gonna give you up. I'm never ever gonna.
that Barry White boy. Made history with that low voice and his songs. Another one took us through the fire, Chaka Khan. As we always talk about Black history and trying to make it through, through the fire. Another impressionable young man who came up through the ranks, as they say, Stevie Wonder, As I Play As.
As I run the sun. to last forever in another day. Just as time knew to move on since the beginning, and the seasons know exactly when to change. The kindness knows no shame, no before your joy and pain. And I'll be loving you always. And today I know I'm living by tomorrow, but make me the past for that I mustn't fear. For I'll know deep in my mind the love of me I left behind. Cause I'll be loving you
I'm
Yes, Patty, walk around heaven.
Going to play where there will be nothing left to do but simply walk around heaven all day.
We get through walking around heaven, Aretha's going to sing, I Say a Little Prayer.
My hand now.
Lord Jesus, we ask you to help us to understand and strengthen us to provide for ourselves and our communities by working together. It takes each and every one of us to come together as the kings and queens that we are and have always been. Thank you.